Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of Comic Week's podcast. I'm Vincent Valk, and my guests today are Ann Colton, who is Executive Vice President for Sustainability, Market Outreach, and Communications at the American Chemistry Council, and Ross Eisenberg, who is Vice President for Federal Affairs at the American Chemistry Council. Hi, Ann. Hi, Ross.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
How are you?
Great, great, and thanks for coming on the podcast today. So we're going to have a talk about climate policy and both what's going on at the federal level and some things that ACC members are doing, ACC being the acronym for American Chemistry Council. If you're listening, you probably know that, but just to be clear. But yes, obviously a lot going on around climate policy right now with the new administration. And, you know, with Earth Day on April 22nd, we thought it would be a good time to kind of catch up on all things climate with ACC. So great to have Ann and Ross on today to discuss those things. And certainly a lot to chew on with regard to this topic. So let's get to it. First of all, and, you know, whichever of you kind of wants to jump in on this one first, feel free. The Biden administration has, not surprisingly to anyone, you know, made climate a priority. What are some of the key sort of initiatives and executive actions that are happening right now with regard to climate that ACC is tracking?
Ross, why don't you go ahead?
Sure, no problem. So we are anxiously awaiting at the end of this week the president's climate summit, where we expect to hear what the new nationally determined contribution level will be from the U.S. And essentially how much we're going to commit to as a country, which will then drive a lot of, you know, the everything else. It'll drive what the initiatives really are going to be and how much teeth they have. But certainly there, as you said, there's a lot going on. The Biden administration has taken a whole of government approach to climate change, and it is, you know, so it is required engagement on the whole of government, which is in a lot of ways a net positive for us. We in the chemical sector make the vast majority of products that are going to be key to doing something about climate change. So there's tremendous opportunities there for us, not without challenges, but certainly tremendous opportunities. In addition to that, some of the things that early on we've been really engaged in, certainly the phase down of hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, which are present in refrigerants. The president has committed to send the Kigali Amendment over to the Senate for ratification. We are working to help them get that done. We support that. We have some just questions about things that they're doing in some areas, like the social cost of carbon and the social cost of methane, which the administration has signaled that they're going to go to essentially the Obama social cost of carbon framework, but they've done it with a fair amount of opacity. And, you know, we agree that there should be a social cost of carbon. We have some ideas on how they can construct it, but we would just like to be led into that process. So, you know, a lot of that's just early government people getting into their jobs and settling in kind of things, but we look forward to working with them on that. And then certainly wherever EPA decides to go, be it on some of the early actions in the fuel economy space or on power plants, but then down the line, how they, if they plan on addressing emissions directly from our sources, what that looks like. Those are all the things that we've been paying attention to from the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm. Anne, do you have anything to add to that?
I guess I would just say that, you know, Ross mentioned that the real positive benefits of the products of chemistry, and we talk about that a lot. We highlight that a lot. I would just mention, though, that, you know, our members are also committed to taking the steps that are needed over the next, you know, few years, few decades to get their own emissions down to a level that's much more, you know, sort of in line with the whatever the nationally determined contribution will be. But it's going to take a lot of effort, a lot of investment, a lot of technology breakthroughs. So it's not something that can happen overnight. But yeah. I want to emphasize, of course, that, you know, we're not just looking at what we create and what it enables others to do. We're looking at our own house as well. That's an important part of our strategy.
Sure. And I mean, I do, you know, want to come back to what members are doing in a little bit. But just a couple more questions about sort of what's going on at the federal government level. Ross, seeing as federal affairs is your purview, I will direct this one to you, though, Anne, if you want to jump in, feel free. You know, the Congress, I know, has started hearings on the Clean Futures Act, and was wondering if you could maybe give an overview of, first of all, what some of the important components of the bill are for chemical manufacturers.
Sure. And, you know, let me just start by saying that our sector is committed to taking congressional action on climate change. We believe that there should be a preferably a congressionally led bill or package that would set our nation's climate policy. So we're happy in a lot of ways to see Congress engaging. You know, like any other 900 something page piece of legislation, there's going to be things in a bill that we like and things that we've got some concerns with. And that certainly is the case on the Clean Futures Act. You know, on the plus side, most of Title III, the energy efficiency provisions, are all things that our association has long supported. Grid resiliency, EV infrastructure, a lot of the sort of clean electricity generation provisions are also things that we like seeing in there. On the flip side, we would really prefer an economy-wide price or some sort of market-based price signal to the more sectoral approach in this bill. This really kind of goes sector by sector. And I think it was born out of frustration with an inability to get a price through. That all being said, it's our preference that we really try to do something economy-wide, transparent, market-based, and just see if we can get that done. The stars are aligning, in our view, in a way that they haven't in a long time, with the business community really coalescing around this concept. It's, you know, challenging to see Congress walking away from that concept. So we really would like to see that happen. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Title IX of that bill, the plastics title. This is the first time that anything specifically targeting a sector has made it, you know, a sector's, you know, production has made it into this bill. We've got some big concerns with that that section. Functionally, it would essentially stop plastics production at the vast majority of plastics manufacturing facilities, advanced recycling facilities, and then the facilities that feed into those facilities. There are ways to address our sector's emissions, and we want to be responsible here. We're comfortable with taking steps to control our emissions, but that's not the way to do it. You don't control emissions by just shutting things down. And so we obviously have some concerns there, but. You know, on the whole, we're engaged with that committee. They've had an open door with us and have been willing to listen. And you know, we feel good with the progress we've made to date, but there's a long way to go.
Sure. I'm curious. Why do you view an economy-wide price on carbon to be preferable to the sectoral approach?
So that's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with predictability, and you know, certainly we've preferred, this is not a new policy for us. I mean, my understanding is that our position on sort of economy-wide price signals is more than a decade old, and was something that this association was advocating long before I got here. But I, you know, the predictability, the transparency, the fact that it's a market-based mechanism and you're not just basically doing command and control type regulations, you know, typically, the business community does better in those situations because it gives us the flexibility to trade, and it gives us flexibility to, you know, if you're in that situation, it gives us the flexibility to, you know, kind of make the decisions on the ground at our plants in a way that is probably a little bit more efficient than having the government tell us what to do. If you have, you know, some of these, you know, look at our facilities. I mean, sometimes there's 10 different product lines running out of one of these gigantic you know, plastics manufacturer or, you know, chemical manufacturing facilities with different chemistries. And, you know, each one of those is going to have a different kind of formula to reducing the emissions. Sometimes it's going to be process emissions. Sometimes it's going to be energy emissions. Sometimes it's going to be something else altogether. And so the government is good at doing things in, you know, here's your standard and stick to it. Whereas for an industry like ours, having the flexibility to kind of make the changes on the ground, you know, in different parts of different facilities might be a little bit better for us. So I think that's in large part why we want to do that. Also, just, you know, a level playing field is always better than just kind of going sector by sector.
Got it. I want to ask one more thing sort of about the Clean Futures Act before moving on to into some other issues, and I'll whichever of you wants to kind of jump in first on this one, feel free. But do you have any sense of whether the Clean Futures Act has a chance of becoming law, or if not? And I would imagine probably not, given the composition of the Senate. If some parts of it are likely to make their way into sort of future climate legislation.
So let me start. I don't believe the bill, the 900 something page bill as written, is likely to move as is and make its way to the president's desk. Mm-hmm. But as you said, there are components of it that I anticipate will be pulled off of it and could make their way into other moving vehicles or moved on their own. Certainly, if we get an infrastructure package, I could see components of this bill making its way into that. It's hard to say which would make it in there, particularly if you wind up with an infrastructure package that is going to be moved through reconciliation, because then it has to have budgetary implications. But certainly, we're viewing it as, you know, this at the end of the day, this is the chief climate change bill introduced by the Democrats in the House, the controlling majority in the House. So we take it very seriously, and it is something that we view as movable, even if it doesn't have the votes, you know, right this instant to get done.
Yeah. Kind of a starting point almost.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anne, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think he summed it up well.
Great. So I want to move a little bit, and Anne, I'll direct this one to you to start. I want to move a little bit to sort of what's going on in the private sector, what's going on in industry and the investor community. There have been a lot of big moves on climate, both from industry and from investors. I mean, we've seen some institutional investors like BlackRock really make ESG, that being environment, social, and governance, for anyone listening that might not be aware of that acronym. We've seen, you know, those kinds of institutional investors make ESG a really big priority, the ratings agencies too. We've seen some pretty strong goals from some of the energy companies, particularly from in Europe, regarding climate. At a high level, Anne, what are some of the key things that ACC members are doing around their own climate policies and their own sort of maybe call it climate mitigation strategies?
Sure. So I think first and foremost, as you mentioned, this idea of reporting and greater transparency and disclosure has gained tremendous momentum within the industry. You know, some of that is, of course, driven by the investment community. Some of it's driven by other stakeholders or just a desire to be more communicative on the part of our members. You know, I think one of the challenges there, and many people talk about this, and it's certainly driving a lot of conversation today, that the number and kind of requests for the different types of information and how various groups or platforms or organizations want emissions data or other ESG type data calculated, reported, expressed, it's really never ending. And I think one of the things that we hope will occur and that we hope to help drive a conversation about is some greater consistency across the board in some of these third party frameworks. And frankly, I think even if you think about what may lie ahead from the governmental side, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission has issued a request for comment on ESG disclosures. So I think this area is moving quickly. I think all of our members are trying very hard, or most of our members, especially those who are publicly traded, are trying very hard to keep up with it all and to be responsive. But when you have individual investors, individual organizations, and individuals and themselves who may have various levels of influence asking for data in different ways, calculated differently, it makes it very complicated and burdensome for the industry to be as responsive and as transparent as they want to be. So I think that's an area where, you know, we may see some concerted industry effort to drive alignment. So there's that point, which is around sort of accounting and transparency. I would also say that there's a lot of work being done on the industry side to think through, you know, what are those technologies and what are those breakthroughs that need to take place to help an industry like ours, which is energy intensive and frankly that uses a hydrocarbon as its primary raw material. How do we leapfrog into the next generation? How do we transform the industry and put those practices in place? Again, it's probably going to be years and decades in the making, but let's start looking at the work that needs to be done now. What role does government need to play in that? You know, one of the things that Ross, you know, has talked about and that we think about too is there's a lot of work that's being done at national labs and otherwise on this. How do we make sure that we are being a collaborative force through some of that and making sure that the processes needed for chemical manufacturing are addressed in some of those activities as well. So I think those are the two really big buckets. You know, what do we got to do in the future? How do we be more transparent today? There are things along the margins around additional energy efficiency improvements that could be made. But frankly, a lot of our companies, they've done that for a variety of reasons, right? You know, a lot of the I'll call it low-hanging fruit has already been picked. So we're left with some really big initiatives that are needed in order to get the industry to the next iteration.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I mean, to kind of dig a little deeper into both of those sides of it, the sort of reporting and transparency side and the technology side. I mean, first on reporting and transparency, you bring up a great point that there are so many different standards and they're sort of inconsistently applied, and different organizations want different standards or different sort of mixtures of sets of standards. Does ACC kind of have a position on that? I mean, are you saying, listen, we're gonna say even it doesn't even necessarily have to be sort of an official thing like responsible care, but it could even just be in the sense of, hey, we're going to encourage our companies to use GRI, the Global Reporting Initiative, for example, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't want to, and we can't, and we wouldn't mandate what kind of third-party system they use. You know, but what we have done is look across the landscape and identified, you know, where some of our members are, I'll call it congregating, if you will. We have a lot of members who use GRI for a variety of reasons. We have a lot of members that rely on the GHG protocol, which was developed by World Resources Institute and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I'll note that's distinct about many of these different frameworks is, you know, you have a system like IPCA, which is used and sponsored by the international oil and gas industry, that tells you, hey, you should report these things, but it doesn't tell you how to calculate it. And so you're also seeing sort of different levels of detail. And I think that's where it gets complicated. You know, we may have, let's say, 90% of our membership who reports publicly some emissions data, whether that's through EPA, because they're above the threshold that's required for reporting there, or it's in a private sector, third party standard organization, you know, application. And the way that they calculate that information is different because they're meeting the requirements of the different organizations. And that's, I think, what gets really complex. It's not that most are asking for vastly different kinds of information. It's how they determine what that information is, right? Okay, and how you put the math that you do, what's included, what's not included, you know, what gets to subtract out here, what's a credit worth, that's where it gets really complicated. And there's a lot of really conflicting guidance. And, you know, I think unfortunately, that's the hardest part, right? Is to doing the side by side and looking across all these different systems and then having some sort of consensus within industry that's going to say, hey, we think this is these are the most material kind of things that are important to our industry. here's where we think that the measurements should be focused. Here's how we think the calculations can be done in a way that's responsive to the interests of external stakeholders, but also makes sense from an industry standpoint. You know, so that's it's hard, like sort of tedious math work that has to be done. And that's what, you know, we're trying to help our members through is identifying where's there this congregation. Could we get folks to move in a similar direction without certainly mandating it? And how can we also maybe facilitate greater input from external voices in sort of a coordinated way so everybody can benefit from hearing, okay, you know, like the investment community or this segment of the investment community really thinks X measurement is really important. And so we can factor that in. So it's maybe a bit less fragmented.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of it is really kind of what goes on in the process of arriving at the figure, sort of under the hood. So
that's right. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you mentioned the research technology is something we've been covering a lot and probably a subject for many other podcasts. So yeah. I don't want to get too into the weeds on it. But I am curious because you also, you know, we were just discussing legislation and Ross just mentioned the infrastructure bill. I mean, I'm wondering is there any opportunity, and maybe this is more of a question for Ross, although, Anne, I don't know if you may also have some insight on it. Is there any opportunity for, you know, some support for some research initiatives from the infrastructure bill or from other sort of federal climate policy or federal climate legislation where, you know, where companies can get some funding or get some kind of mechanism to help push some of this research forward? Because I know there is a lot going on in that area.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start and then, you know, let Ross put me in my place if he wants to. I mean, in my personal opinion, yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. Now, I think the catch is how you pay for that, right? And is it technology neutral? Is it picking winners and losers? But I will say, I think if you look across the industry, one of the points Ross made is, you know, we have companies with large portfolios where they're making different chemicals in different ways and the solution isn't going to be uniform. So I think there is a lot of opportunity to, I'll just say, spread the wealth a little bit. And so you're seeing multiple technologies come forward. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket where you're naturally going to disadvantage one group or another that doesn't rely specifically on that technology. But I'll pass it to Ross, who can maybe elaborate on where we are on all those issues.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm just going to echo a lot of what Anne said. There are tremendous opportunities in the infrastructure plan and in some of the provisions inside that Clean Future Act, in some of the other bills that are moving around to crack this nut and really start, scale up the kinds of public and private investment that are going to be needed in these technologies for us to comply on our end and reduce our emissions and do our part, but also for the economy writ large to do it. And so, there are tremendous opportunities. I mean, the amount of investment that the Biden infrastructure plan puts into sort of green and clean energy technologies is once in a generation type stuff. But as Anne said, the rub is how you're going to pay for it. We have tremendous concerns over the proposal to pay for that by basically increasing taxes across the board for the same companies that you're asking to then take on all these new costs in to comply with new climate standards. So there's got to be a better way to do that. Certainly, going after the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act isn't the way we would prefer to do it. But, you know, on its face, yeah, and we have a long history of supporting these kinds of initiatives. So in the last Congress, a bill called the Clean Industrial Technology Act got done with our strong support. That's a bill that essentially would help DOE better coordinate the different climate focused programs at the agency. Certainly, there's a lot more we could do to scale up access to the labs and engagement with the private sector. You know, on almost any one of the technologies that we are going to need, that we, the chemical industry, are going to need, and we, the U.S. economy, are going to need, whether it's carbon capture or hydrogen or advanced batteries or energy efficiency, these are all ripe for additional investment, additional coordination, and that is a place where the federal government can be a key player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And it definitely is going to be require a fair bit of collaboration across the economy and across the government. So wanted to ask now, and I'll direct this question towards Anne. What feedback have you been getting from members about climate policy, both from sort of a regulatory or legislative point of view, and from the point of view of just what's happening in industry, what's happening in business, and I'll even add maybe to some extent what's happening around the world, because you know there's a lot that's going on around climate in Europe and in China, and for example that will affect the U.S. industry as well, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think you heard some of it already. I think you know this concern about making sure that we, okay, I'll use just a bad metaphor, don't rob Peter to pay Paul, right? Mm-hmm. Let's not disadvantage American manufacturers by making massive tax changes just so we can invest in the technology. You know, you sort of wonder where does that come out in the end. So needing something, you know, that doesn't hurt the competitiveness of the U.S. industry, really looking at how to advance some of these technologies and systems in a technology neutral way where we're not naturally picking one set of winners and, you know, putting everything else aside. You know, I think the idea of something that is federal and economy wide is important. You know, as with many issues, you know, we're not alone in this. Many industries face these kind of, you know, snack attacks at the state level where you're ending up with a hodgepodge of approaches that really don't benefit anyone in the long run. So, you know, getting a federal solution, I think, is quite important to our members as well. But generally speaking, as Ross said, there's a lot of support for forward progress by our members. I think, you know, this issue, climate, has been around for a while. You know, it sort of has peaks and valleys, but certainly the momentum for action and policy action is substantial right now. And we'd like to see those meaningful, productive, constructive solutions that are going to help heavy industries like ours, as well as other parts of the economy, transportation and otherwise, electricity generation, help us all move towards that future that is really what I think many consumers, certainly stakeholders, and the global community is looking for.
Yeah. You know, I'll ask this because you both mentioned some concerns around the current plans for paying for the infrastructure bill. Does ACC have a position, or do you just have a thought on what would perhaps be a better method to pay for it, if not these sort of corporate tax increases?
You know, I don't know that we do. And so much of it depends on how the legislative text shakes out. So until we see some of this stuff in print, and it's not just a plan, we won't really be able to say much. We do have concerns about some of the, you know, a lot of the heavy-handed tax proposals in there. So, you know, that's not going to work, but hopefully there's something else out there that we can come around.
Got it. And finally, I'll direct at both of you. I actually would like to get answers from both of you. So whoever wants to jump in first, feel free. But, you know, what does ACC see as the key priorities and principles for climate policy? And how do you see these kind of principles and priorities impacting the U.S. chemical industry?
I'll let Ross go first on that one.
Okay, sounds good. I'll start by saying the directive from our members has been pretty clear. They told us they want to be at the table and they want to be part of the solution. And you're going to see out of us and out of our members over the next few months and years, you're going to see that that play out. We are putting ourselves at the table in a way that maybe we haven't been before. ACC and this industry has largely been part of climate conversations on the Hill for a while. So it's not necessarily new, but I think you're going to see us scale up our presence a bit because we really see an opportunity for this industry to help drive some smart solutions here. And, you know, within that, we do think that there are some key priorities here. The first and foremost is what we've been talking about for most of this conversation, increasing government investment in scientific resources to develop and deploy low emissions technologies in the manufacturing sector. You have to have those technologies in place, and you have to give us the time to develop them so that we can put them in place and actually and clean up our emissions as well as the rest of the economy's emissions, because so much of what we make is key to that. So really scaling up those technologies really is component number one. Number two is going to be that economy-wide market-based price signal. We think that's the smartest and the most direct and transparent way to handle emissions across the board. And we think that it would be a key component of a policy on that would work on climate. Within that, we also do believe that you need to do something about feedstock emissions feedstock emissions is a good way to put it. Primarily, if let's say we are making a product that has natural gas is a core component, a feedstock component of a lot of the chemicals we make. Well, a lot of the time that natural gas is cracked and the actual hydrocarbon, it's not actually emitted. It just goes into the product. And so if it's not emitted, we shouldn't have to pay for the emissions. And so figuring out a way to handle those feedstocks is something that we care deeply about. And then also the as an energy intensive trade exposed industry, doing something in terms of a border adjustment to make sure that, we're not unilaterally doing something that our competitors are not and making ourselves less competitive. So you can handle that through border adjustment mechanisms, and we think that's the way to go. The last policy and principle that I think is really important is that piece that we've been talking about as well. Leverage the power of the business of chemistry so that we can deploy climate-friendly products and technologies. All of the things we make go into all of the things that will help address climate change. So 96% of manufactured goods are powered by the business of chemistry here. And so that's going to matter in buildings and construction and power generation in vehicles, across the economy. And so getting those products into the market, getting the retrofits done into homes and businesses and things like that, and newer technologies in cars and trucks and trains and planes. This is what we do, and this is really a core component of solving the climate challenge. So I'll stop there. I think that's probably a good place to turn it over to Anne.
Yeah, I think Ross put it really well. Those are our primary principles. I think, just to sum it up, the business of chemistry can be, is, and will tomorrow be part of the solution to climate change. We know we have work to do to reduce emissions in our own operations. We have plans that we're developing in order to help our members and the broader chemical industry pursue that. We want to ensure that we have the right technologies in place, that as we look to the future, we're supporting that transformation of industry into, the chemical industry of the 21st century and beyond. We are a large part of this economy. The business of chemistry actually accounts for 25% of the U.S. GDP. So, not only from a technology standpoint and all of those products that we make, but also from an economic standpoint, having the right pieces in place to ensure that our industry can support ongoing growth across the economy, the export and deployment of strategies and of products like renewable energy, lightweight vehicles, electric charging stations, energy efficiency for homes and buildings, all of that relies on the products we make. So, it really is, looking at us as two parts of the solution, working to get our own house in order as we look to the future, but also making sure that we are providing and meeting the demand for those energy savings and emissions savings technologies that the rest of the world's going to need in order to meet their climate goals as well.
Yeah, for sure. There's obviously a lot of technology and a lot of what the industry does that, as you said, goes into many of these things. For example, that carbon capture, lithium ion batteries, the list goes on, and that's just scratching the surface. And I think, we're very much at the beginning of this, right? It's the energy transition. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here. But thanks very much for your time, Ross and Anne. Very much enjoyed talking to you. And this is Vincent Volk signing off for Chemical Week.